Sandy Hook, off New York coast, 1912. RMS Olympic moved through the water. Captain Smith was on the bridge. From below the sea, the huge triple screw propellers churned through the blue depths. On deck, all looked clear. Then suddenly a crash. The ship seemed to drag. It had hit something. The crash jolted through the hull. It must have hit the propeller, for it stopped. "All stop," yelled Captain Smith. He felt the sure jolt of what was the sign of disaster. But it was too late. The first officer yelled into the phone, "All stop." The engine room got the call and sent the message, yelling "All stop," into the tubes. The engines went full stop, giving what was asked of them. Smith ran to the deck. There was no sign that they struck another ship. It must have come from underwater. "Close the bulkhead doors. Alert the crew," Smith ordered. He was sure and quick. In an instant, the orders flew from his tongue. He was fast on deck. "Damage report," he said. The ship vibrated hard and dense. The big turbines shuddered. The great valves, protruding up through the hull, were being asked more than they were ever built for, as they screeched to a halt. The keel was vibrating hard. It carried the intensity, running the length of the ship. "It's below the waterline, check for damage, report to me at once," Smith could feel it. "This ship has had it." "We were already creeping along," said the chief engineer. Down below, the men were frightened. They thought any minute rivets would bust, bringing water bursting in. No one wanted to make that journey in the dank hull and be the first to die. There was no option at sea but to save the ship or abandon it. Down the dark passageway, in the bowels of the ship, the crew checked and kept watch for signs of water. The chief turbine engineer was especially in fear as he watched the metal shattering. The big thick turbine was under strain with all this vibration, and if she cracked, it was hell to them all. The intricate welding held and proved that the fine craftsmanship of the hull saved the ship. The engine chief yelled, "Check every valve." There were valves all over, from the stern aft, and they all had to be manned now in detail. The turbine held. The crew held together too, making repairs and tightening the valves that were found leaking. The strain on the crew was heavy. Olympic had already been repaired in an attempt to keep her in service. She now had a wrecked propeller, a huge vibration, and a list. From her engine room to the water fountain at the stairwell, the damage was apparent. It would be all she could do to head home. Could Morgan get insurance since it was an accident in the United States? Smith thought. There was no sleep that night as the men watched the engines closely, for they were sure they would spring a leak or be jolted out of place by this continual vibration. The water in the swimming pool had a continuous shrill pattern. The vibration left no part of the ship untouched. The trip from the New York coastline was sure to be her last trip. Smith needed the men. He was not about to stop at port where he could lose his crew. And so, crippled, would Olympic return to Belfast for repairs, interrupting work on Titanic once again. Chapter 37. New York, February 1912. Jack held a telegram from Ismay, chairman of the White Star Line. "You should have gotten rid of Captain Smith," said Jack. "RMS Olympic's been in another accident. He is going to bankrupt us." Morgan didn't look at Jack. "That's the third one. And she's not even been in service yet a year," said Jack, stunned. Morgan would lash out irrationally, regardless of whether or not Jack was the source of his displeasure. You better read it, he said. Morgan ignored the telegram as Jack held it out. The old man seemed strangely calm. He stood back. Aren't you going to read it? Jack feared the worst. The telegram said, To Morgan from Ismay. Olympic hit submerged wreck off NY stop propeller. Blade lost, stop, had to return to H&W again. Stop, severe vibrational damage to engines. Suspected, stop, update later, stop, best. Regards, stop. Jack couldn't believe it. Morgan was not at all moved. So you're not angry? What the hell? I thought you would be through the roof, said Jack. Just claim the insurance. This time it wasn't my ship's fault, Morgan smiled. It all came clear to Jack, not the details, but the way the old man worked. Desperate times call for desperate measures and all that crap he had heard before. It all just meant, do what you have to come out on top, Jack thought. He was sure that something devious had gone down. Morgan crumpled the telegram into a wad. While he didn't share his thoughts, his craggy, age-worn face was relaxed free from the expected flush of anger. It wasn't cross. It wasn't readable either. Chapter 38 Morgan's Yacht, Night, February, 1912. Morgan was in his sitting room with his mistress. This was a moment of time that Morgan needed, away from all that bickering and business. His hand found its way around her bow and fondled her breast. The other hand found her stern. She was well endowed on the deck, so to speak. This is where Morgan came to get away from it all. Sex was always a great distraction. Even an old barnacle like Morgan needed attention. The other part of his life was all harsh and guarded. Here now, with this beauty, he could relax. Sure, it cost him dearly, but he was past that. He had enchanted his mistress and women friends with expensive trinkets and jewels. It was never his personality or his looks. It was his power that drove them to him. Women were attracted to that kind of thing. It was a pleasant exchange. He fondly cared for his mistress. She was the one he wanted to share his bed. Since meeting her, he was mesmerized. When with her, he forgot the external grind. As often as he could, he would steal away to this time for himself. It rejuvenated his spirit and made him feel younger. He slipped his hand gently inside her dress and found her smooth skin. His big hand was soft. It still had the sensual touch, as it gently held her breast and nipples. He grabbed her hips. He lifted her dress and shrugged off her panties. As he unbuttoned his trousers, he pushed her back on the sofa. The shadows of the dark room played against her tummy and her naked skin. The hard banging at the door was not a welcome sound. He knew the knock. Bella slipped back into her dress as Morgan threw on his pants and opened the door. Andrews entered in a hard, disturbing manner. What the hell? Morgan ranted. Andrew's steps were fast and angry across the room. He threw a map at Morgan's desk. Andrews was not welcomed. But he must dare to speak up. I know what you did, he said. Morgan caught sight of the map and heard the angry tone. Andrews thought twice about his intrusion, but he had to confront Morgan if it was the last thing he ever did. It was now or never that he'd impress upon Morgan his disdain. What is this interruption? Morgan, almost a half bottle of scotch under, was indignant to be pulled away from the attentions of Bella. Morgan motioned her to leave the room. She dallied a moment fixing her buttons and then in a sultry walk, made her way to the door. Morgan's eyes followed her stern the whole way. Andrews waited till the door was closed and they were in private. You had the Olympic hit that sunken wreck. That was a chartered vessel. You're trying to collect the insurance any way you can. Well, I won't be part of it. What's it matter to you? Said Morgan. He opened his box of cigars, cut the tip and flared up a match, puffing to get it going. Who are you to question me? He spat out as he paced, frothing like a wild animal. There is no insurance. They claim it was a chartered wreck, he said. God damn it. What do you have to do to get insurance? I don't believe this. Morgan's angry voice echoed through the air. He'd had setbacks before. But there was so much at stake here. Morgan went to the desk and studied a map of the Atlantic. Let me redesign Titanic or another accident like this will happen for sure, Andrews begged. You would have me just throw away a ship? I've invested more than you can fathom, said Morgan softly. All you've done is insured her list and torn up the propeller. What can you expect me to do? She's vibrating through the engines. Fix it. How? She's thrashed, claimed Andrews. Morgan was in no mood to argue as he moved his hand over the diagram of the propeller for Olympic. A look came over his face. Then he pulled out the diagram for Titanic. You keep her afloat till we tow her to Belfast, said Morgan coolly. He mellowed even more. He was already thinking moves ahead of Andrew. It was too late for Andrews to do anything about it. Andrews, so nervous in the presence of Morgan's softening eyes, ranted on, not knowing what to do. I tried to get you a run or so out of her. She was patched up as best we could after the Hawk incident, to have her hold till Titanic was ready to voyage the sea and make up for your investment. This latest accident of Olympic was the final nail in her coffin. But Morgan wasn't yelling. He was hardly listening. Andrews couldn't believe he wasn't in a fit. So is Morgan listening to me? He wondered. He better say all. While he could. Even if we kept her operating at greatly reduced speeds, to try and preserve her superstructure just a little longer, she was already gone from the Hawk hit to the keel. With the vibrational damage she suffered after losing the propeller blade, it's just, well, you see what I'm saying. She is unseaworthy. She's nothing more than 46,000 tons of scrap metal. Andrews. Titanic is having her final finishing touches, Morgan said. Yes, replied Andrews. And Olympic is going to Belfast? Yes, Andrews said. They will be docked side by side, stated Morgan. Yes, Andrews nodded. They are almost identical, stated Morgan. Yes. Said Andrews. Morgan looked at the blueprints. He puffed smoke and it hovered above, a constant cloud about him. He studied the structural lines of the ship. You can make them look identical? Asked Morgan. Well. Yes, said Andrews. Well then do so, said Morgan. Andrews did not ask the reason. Titanic was indeed almost complete. With Olympic side by side with her, they indeed were almost identical. Morgan's thoughts were hidden well in his face. He downed his scotch. There was a momentary silence, as he ran his hand over the blueprints, the cigar between his fingers. A plan was deftly laid. These were the original documents. Meticulously drawn by hand, the The Harlan and Wolff stamp embedded in the paper, the pen mark of the copyist signed on the corner. Morgan would put them to good use. Put Titanic's propeller on Olympic. Titanic's not using it yet. Get me one last run on Olympic, requested Morgan politely. But it's the same faulty propeller, said Andrews. Morgan gave but a simple look. Andrews dared not speak. He looked at the blueprint Morgan had laid out and he watched as Morgan pointed to Olympic's frame and then Titanic's. He didn't hear the words Morgan spoke, but he knew what Morgan wanted. A strange silence of the night came over him. He felt the reality of the plan, although it was as if he was someone else outside himself hearing it. His hand motioned across the two blueprints, but it was as if someone else's hand was pointing, as if someone else's voice was agreeing. Andrews wrote some figures, made some measurements. He rolled up the chart and put it under his arm all in a daze. He unhappily tipped his hat, adjusted his coat and scarf and went out to the deck. Even in the stiff chilly wind Andrews could not recover. His eyes stared straight, as he stood and watched his feet take the steps to get him off Morgan's odious ship. He passed a few intoxicated guests that Morgan had. Men of stature, they seemed. One of the men, he was sure, was a senator. A couple of provocative women were entertaining them. The chilled evening air made their nipples stand out behind their silken sequins. He wanted to make his way off the ship and decipher the events of the evening. It was all a reminder to Andrews that he was but a tiny and important piece of the Morgan machine and he could do little to stop it. Chapter 39 Atlantic Siren, 1993. A few of them were around the table after dinner just finishing the last of the wine. The tug incident showed Olympic's propeller was faulty. They paid off the tugs for damages, said Jade. She looked at the outline and notes she had made. Olympic had the crash with the HMS Hawk. Now she's claimed a wreck with a Ben Keel. White Star tries but can't claim insurance. They try to patch her up, and then she's somewhat seaworthy. She goes out and hits a sunken vessel with Captain Smith at the wheel again. She's declared a wreck and now the propeller is mangled. White Star makes another insurance claim. They are denied. They dock the ship's side-by-side switch Olympic's propellers with Titanic. And then order cosmetic repairs. If she's a wreck, what are they putting any money into her for? Either Morgan's an idiot or it's something else. And then there's the official records that say RMS Olympic served as a troop ship in World War I and was at sea 25 years before retiring, Jade Reed. Does that make any sense to you? Masters lit a cigarette as he looked at Jade. This was more than he had bargained for. She questioned the official Harlan and Wolff records. How could Olympic sustain such damage and still do another 25 years at sea? But that was the way it read in the records. You don't have to know much about shipbuilding to know if the keel is bent your ship is gone. It's not worth repairing, especially in a ship like that, where you had to build the parts inside the hull. It's just not cost-effective, Max said. And Morgan is all about money. He's a banker. He wouldn't want to spend money that he wouldn't get back, she added. That's why he repaired it, so he could get another 25 years out of it, said Masters. But who made the records? She asked. There's no way Olympic, with a messed up keel, could move troops for the military. The White Star couldn't get insurance, it was so thrashed, Max stood firm. White Star couldn't get insurance cause she was at fault, said Masters. You really believe Olympic was shattered by the Hawk's ram and ended 25 years of transatlantic service after that? Come on, said Jade as she was cut off. "That's not going to be in the film," Masters hardened. "Not while I'm playing for it." Why was Olympic dismantled? They could have made it a docked hotel like the Queen Mary. The most beautiful ship ever made, and instead they dismantle it. They could have made a ton off tourists, she said. Better than this video tour. "Is that what you propose?" asked Masters. Jade brought up photos of the bell found on Titanic. "This is fascinating. Then you have the propeller with an identifying mark, yet the bell is not identified," she came at Masters. He hardened now as he sat, quiet, listening, getting what she knew, what he could use for his attack. Jade pulled up an old file that showed several famous ship bells throughout history. All had the ship's names clearly engraved on them, unlike Titanic's, which was bare. Masters stared hard at them. "Doesn't a ship put the name on the bell? If this is the most exclusive ship in the world, they would flaunt it," she imposed. "So it wore off," said Flynn. "On the maiden voyage, right?" "Remarkable," she said. "Don't they engrave bells with deep engraving that can't wear off, even in 100 years? Bedeck's plate is down by the elevator and it's rusted, but it is still readable." Flynn looked at the detailed pictures of the front bell as Jade and the pointed to the tail scratches. "Was there a name there?" Jade asked. "Just can't tell," said Flynn. Master sat disgusted. Mac was getting some of this on film. "You know what always caught my attention was the way it landed flat on the bottom. It's one reason the bow is so well preserved. If she would have done a nosedive, well, both sections would be a mess. How could that have happened?" "That even sinking never made sense," said Johns. "Why didn't it capsize?" "That is a real good question. There are a million questions we could bring up about the Lusitania. Masters had drunk a bit too much wine." "And it bothers you?" she boldly came back. "Still, it is fascinating. It's got my curiosity." "I don't want controversy in the film I have in mind," he said. "It's more about the exploration. Going down the corridors and into the boiler room, finding the ship. Seeing her as she is now, how she's held up. Where is the intrigue in that? Wrecks have always been romanticized. They always will be. It sells tickets. Masters was right." He wondered what was going through Jade's mind. He was intrigued, but she was dangerous, distracting him from his purpose at hand. It was on her face. He saw it, the change in her. She wasn't there for him anymore. "I can use all the footage that you have," she tried again. "No, you are not going to have that till I see what you've cut together. If you bring up these questions, it will bring 1,000 guys down here tearing her apart. I won't help you do that." "I see your point. But then, you're going to cut into the hull for this gold. So what's the difference?" "There is no mercy for Titanic even in death," Masters could not deny. He searched himself. At first thinking that he was drifting where he pleased, he soon realized that he was being sucked into her wake. He had seen himself a visionary through a long, boundless, and systematic sheltering of all his senses. His suffering aloofness exhausted within himself all the passion that once had filled him. If he was destroyed in his ecstatic, unheard-of affair with Titanic, so be it. Jade was unearthing the skeleton grave that held his body. No other had come to touch him so. His horrible thoughts began at the horizons, where they were cast as far as the stars. His soul was in torment, wrapped all around him in a numb cloak, as if it had been sucked dry and then taken in the night. He was incapable of explaining it. He was reaching to grasp the unknown, empty of all senses. He didn't want to see, but only stay blind to the candle that must blow out. He wished to be like the lost souls of Titanic. Floating. Washed clean. Wishing only to sink and become one with the sea in the bottomless night that had exiled him. Jade, silent, looked away, not bearing to see his emptiness. All of you stop. Stop. Astra's turned. We're here to photograph the wreck of Titanic, he said to her. This is not a forensic examination. He looked at the bunch. The crew was clearly off track. It was her fault. This jumped-up filmmaker got to him somewhere deep inside, crowding out the serenity he had cultivated in his soul. The night eluded Masters as he turned his eyes from her, tormented. If you don't bring the gold up now, someone else will. She'll be torn to bits. Subs landing on her decks, destroying what's left of her, Jones reminded him. Actually not, if no one knows about it, Masters told him. What about Dudley? Flynn was cut off. I'll take care of Dudley. You work for me, the frigid tone shot from Masters' lips. The thought of losing the gold did not sit well with Flynn. He was determined they would make the trip and finally bring up the gold. Why waste all the sophisticated equipment, and the bots just on a video? We're not going to tear her apart on some vague idea Dudley has about gold, he said. He'd just get someone else, said Flynn. I'll let you know when the time comes how I'll handle that. Yeah, but what about the gold in the purser's safe? Treaded Johns. Masters reminded him. For now we do the video tour our shots and the stills for the mosaic. He turned to Jade. You get video of us making the last run to Titanic, that's the job, said Masters. Flynn and Johns left the table. Mac tightened up, as Jade got the grill from Masters. He picked up on this melancholy recluse with his fangs deep in Jade. He grabbed the camera and his equipment. He didn't like getting the brush off. He didn't like Jade being given the runaround. He had no obligation to Masters. Maybe Johns and Flynn did, but not Mac. He had kept his distance. He felt an outsider. He and Jade were hired help. Mac's body tightened, his fist clenched. His stomach tensed up as if expecting to punch Masters' lights out. His blood was up. He stared him down, threateningly. Masters stood hardened. Too much being cooped up, more that the wine, had put the fight in him, but he would only use words. Words could control people. They were power. He could fire Mac, but he knew he needed the crew. He had a purpose for each. He wasn't about to lose one needed member to petty issues. They locked eyes on each other for a long moment. Masters kept his cool. No words were spoken by either, but there was a tense silence before Mac went to the door. Jade was too close now to stop searching the mystery that lay before her. Chapter 40 Atlantic Siren, 1993. Later that cold, clear night. There were a million twinkling stars overhead, unobstructed by any interference from man's trivial presence. They stretched from one side of the horizon to the other, with the Milky Way, constellations, and the planets all vying for attention. The stars were too endless to count that night, shooting across some faraway expanse, burning out in some distant end of the galaxy, all before she could blink an eye. Celestial navigation would have been easy for any seafaring man who read the heavens and welcomed them for his guide on this beautiful, North Atlantic night. Few, if any, had acquired this fine knowledge, as computer navigation had taken the lead over such skills. A figure moved about on the empty deck, and darted into the corner. In a black hoodie, the figure waited, still and silent. It was Jade. Watching surreptitiously from the shadows, she made sure that no one was around to observe her movements. She was frozen, not from the cold but from the deed she was about to do. She felt a heavy panic rising in her chest. She was not used to doing this kind of thing. What was she doing? What was she getting herself into? She knew that what she wanted was but feet from her grasp, but here in the corner she was stuck between accomplishing the undercover deed, or leaving, never knowing if she could pull it off. She wondered if she should just go back to her cabin, as if she had only been out for fresh air. How easy that would be. How the night closed in around her, never letting go her thirst for answers. The night would not quench this deep burden that dragged her to this moment, until she forged onward, no matter the risk, to the quest ahead. In the dark, her small flashlight led the way, its beam shaky from her trembling hand. Hopefully, the crew would all be asleep. She passed the piles of equipment stashed in the exterior corridor and made her way inside the ship, with only the battery-run strip of light to differentiate anything in the dark. She pulled her hood up tight, to brace from the cold, determined to get answers to her burning questions. This was the moment. Quit and leave empty-handed, or break into Master's computer. There was no other choice as her one foot made its way in front of the other and had made the decision. Her curiosity had been intrigued. It gave her courage to delve into the mystery of so many questions she had. Suddenly, a cold and clammy hand touched her. In the darkness it startled her. Caught already, before she had even done the deed. Shit. It was all over before it began. At least she knew she had it in her to go through with it. The curiosity of who had caught her, the feel of the cold clammy hand that grabbed stiff against the material of her hoodie, surmounted the surreal moment. She turned and pointed the flashlight at the figure. Startled, the hand let go. She saw her captor as she turned. It was the black gloved hand of an old diving suit hanging there on a dummy that had caught the tail of her hoodie. She breathed again, relieved, and ventured on. The computer room door was locked. Through the porthole she stretched to see into the cabin and saw that the room was deserted. The computer was powered up. She took a deep breath and gingerly climbed up through the unlocked porthole. Clunging in and falling to the floor on the other side, she was in. She came to the computer and placed her blank DVD in. She searched for the file that she had watched Flynn going through earlier. Looking through the files, she scrolled down and found the one. She copied it. As her fingers hit the keys, she saw them trembling, unable to stop the unconscious human reaction of fear that her body gave into. What was fear? Why did the adrenal glands pump the fluid rushing through the body to raise her heartbeat? It all hit her, she had nothing else to focus on. It made it worse. Her shallow breath in the dark of the cabin and the whirling disc were the only sounds. It seemed to take forever for the footage to copy. She looked around nervously. And there in the dark her flashlight came straight upon the model of Titanic. In the cold blackness of the still night it looked somehow ominous. In her fallen state, Titanic still held her dignity. Jade looked at her a long time, mesmerized, woman to woman. Titanic seemed to be drawing Jade to her, beckoning Jade to find the secrets that were held in her rusting corpse. The seconds were stretched out in some realm of time she had not known, which orbited around her, watching her, waiting to catch her. Time was her enemy, time was taking forever, making the wait trying. Time could be cruel. She felt it right now, merciless, preying upon the creatures of Earth. The sound of the machine clicking made her jump. The transfer ended. She removed it and went out through the door, securely locking it behind her. She made her way back through the hallway. In the safety of her cabin, she opened up her own computer and began the process in reverse, uploading the stolen information onto it. She flipped back her sweater hood and rubbed her tired and aching neck, not willing to stop work, even though the hour was reaching close to 2 a.m. She needed a beer. She popped one. This was the only chance she would have to get to put this information into some sensible framework. She dabbled with the script. What was being hidden? She thought, as she waited for the transfer. Her neck was in knots as she rubbed it, trying to push the tension away. She felt adrift on the evening tide. She needed another beer. She sat and put her feet up. The first images could clearly be seen now. Camera images from the previous dives drew her close to the screen. There was a clear image of the entrance to the first-class restaurant. Somehow Masters had gotten his zoom lens through the window. The carpeted floor had long since rotted away, exposing a tiled floor. Many of the tiles had now been worked loose, as the glue holding them in place had disintegrated over the long years. Jade stared hard at the image as she enlarged the frame. There was now no doubt at all, as she had thought earlier, that there was considerable wear and use to the floor. That didn't fit with it being a new ship. Then came a sudden knock at the door. She caught her breath, turned, and put her ear to the door, listening, hoping it wasn't Masters. "It's me," Mac whispered, not wanting to rouse the crew from their slumbers. She eased her breath and her heart composed itself to some semblance of normal. As she opened the door for him, he strode through, smiling in his confident way. "Shit," Mac accused her. "You got their tapes?" He joined her at the computer monitor and together they scanned the footage of the propeller. "So is that 401? Can you see? It's kinda dark." Jade let him in close to the screen. "Then why is the propeller back on Titanic?" she asked. Searching quickly, she found old photographs of the two mighty liners, Olympic and Titanic, docked side by side. She brought up more photos, sifting quickly through them, trying to find the ones she wanted, the ones that would prove beneficial to her documentary. "I thought the logical place for Titanic to break is the expansion joint. I mean, I'm no expert, but we've got to ask, why didn't it break there?" Mac said. Jade made no quick judgment. She brought up the original plans of the two ships and generated a computer-enhanced image of the interiors. The lines of Olympic were superimposed on those of Titanic and the differences were highlighted in red by the computer program. The plans showed slightly different lines on the bridge. The last changes ordered by Harland and Wolf. Then she found something that drew her attention. Chapter 41. Atlantic Siren, 1993. There in the footage was a letter and paper with a peculiar picture on it. Jade got that expression. She knew she had something. "Look at this drawing by the officer who was in the lifeboat, and the letter. They said they heard the explosion and then she bowed in from the middle like a V-shape. It said it all." By now Mac filmed her at the screen. "An explosion," said Mac. "Maybe Masters is wrong. Maybe she broke like this officer said. Here is his eyewitness talking about an explosion." She brought up the next page. This was as good as anything Masters had said, and it made a lot more sense. Jade liked that angle. "The testimony accounts from Mackay Bennett, the ship that had picked up the bodies from Titanic's wreckage, were in these files too. No wonder Masters didn't want her in here. The first page read. As daybreak hit with an overcast sky out on the North Atlantic, a rolling fog crawled along the sea. It was the morning of April, 1912, and the seascape was spread like a graveyard, as far as one could see, with pieces of wreckage that bobbed in the swells. The ocean loudly washed against the sides of the little cutter and with an occasional thump that kicked up surf over the gunwale. Wreckage pieces of the grand staircase, doors, chairs, tables and scattered remains were everywhere. He picked up a piece of the grand staircase rail. He knew it was from the staircase because of its curve and fine craftsmanship. But it shocked him as he saw the edges where she had blown to bits from an explosion, he thought. He laid it in his pack as a sad remembrance of the great ship. The dim sunlight scared the daylights out of the five men aboard the little boat as they entered the forever field of lily-white life vests. It was on its first run to recover bodies that day. They saw the white fragments that dotted the sea moving along the waves, like bobbing ice. But it wasn't ice. These white specks were dead passengers and crew members, in their white life belts, left over from the Titanic disaster only 6 days ago. The sight was traumatic. Something you could never imagine, nor erase from your mind. The heads of the passengers slumped over their life vests, as they bobbed out of the water. The oars tapping the water and squeaking in the oar locks were the only sound that cold morning. Slowly the oars dropped and rose. It all became silent as the men approached one of the bodies. It was Alma Pålsson, a 30-year-old Swedish emigrant. Her hair and arms frolicked around, affording the men a sense of the water's current. Her head was drawn back, and she faced upward, like a figurine broken off an old ship's bow. Sometimes her entire body disappeared under a larger wave. She had been cut off from her four children, who went down with the Titanic, and from her husband in Chicago. Hundreds like her buoyed between the clefts of waves. As the crewman pulled her sea-drenched body into the boat, the steamer Mackay Bennett stood nearby. Mrs. Pålsson was put on ice in the ship's hold, in hope she would be in some condition to photograph for identification, while she was brought back to port. In her pockets were her personal items, a letter from husband, Nils, in Chicago, 65 Swedish kroner, and her steamship ticket. Each was tagged, to identify it. Mrs. Pålsson was one of several hundred bodies recovered by various ships, in April and May 1912. After Titanic's disaster, roughly 1,526 people died, most going down with the ship. But several hundred were either buried at sea, brought back, claimed by relatives, or buried in Halifax. Jade now felt the fate of this woman, left so stone cold. She had never realized this horror. She took note at what she read next. The bodies found floating in their life vests on that cold morning were mostly third-class passengers, emigrants and crewmen. They were children, mothers and fathers. Some of the bodies indeed appeared battered, bruised, and cut up from the event. Cut up. That goes along with the idea of an explosion. Otherwise they would have just drowned. The letter I found earlier noted wreckage. And precisely, pieces of the grand staircase. To have pieces of the staircase floating about means it blew up and parts landed in the water. The guy said it looked like an explosion took out the grand staircase and scattered the remains, she said. The letter brought up a lot of questions. The photos of the bodies that Jade looked at were the starkest testimony to the ravages wrought by the Titanic's mystery. Other ships that had sunk had drowned passengers. So why the bruised bodies? Explosions make for bruised and scored bodies, said Jade. The photos were unaltered and raised the question. Jade was just hoping these photos would help prove that. These should be in the film, she said. Maybe that's too much, said Mac. He saw she was distraught as she read. Rostron turned the Carpathia West and steamed off, leaving the wreckage. Mrs. Poulson, along with hundreds of others, buoyed about her shoulders, head and face up, eyes almost closed, mouth agape. She would silently suffer through six more days and nights of humiliation. The Carpathia's wake clapped on her forehead, said Jade into her microphone. All the while in the court case, Senator Smith didn't question reasons for the bodies being bruised, she read. She read the inquiry report. This whole inquiry is about the bodies being left by the Carpathia. Not a word about the bruises on the bodies being from an explosion, she said. She went down the list of the testimony of the officers and passenger as they recalled the stories. She wondered why the passenger's eyewitness accounts said one thing and the testimony of the officers said another. She read. The bodies were frozen by the cold North Atlantic at night, and were treacherously bleached by the sun during the day. The cruel sea dunked their faces in the water, they became wrinkled and discolored. Mary Wilburn wrote the sea became littered with bodies, the words came as from voices leagues under the sea. The dead came up holding children in their arms. The poor people never had a chance, read Jade. The whole trial doesn't even address the fact that there was an explosion. They're making it about the bodies not being picked up like it was Rostron's fault, not Titanic's fault, she said. It makes perfect sense as May ordered Rostron out of the area. He didn't want Rostron to see the evidence, the battered bodies and floating debris. He might have started asking questions. She couldn't finish. Mac put down the camera. So as May ordered Captain Rostron to go to New York instead of staying there to pick up bodies, said Mac. They had to have an investigation. So they bade and switch a distraction, going after Rostron, instead of trying to find out what happened, he added. The Mackay Bennett was chartered in Halifax, Nova Scotia, by Titanic's owners, to go to the scene. She was outfitted with coffins, canvas bags, and embalming fluid to recover the bodies. They could recover them then seal them in coffins, so nobody saw them, said Mac. You'll bring back cut-up bodies, people start asking questions. That's why they buried so many at sea, the ones that were blown to shreds. All during Carpathia's trip back to New York, Rostron took orders from Ismay, the managing director of the Titanic, Jade said. Why was he giving orders? Said Mac. Cause he wanted to protect his ass. Ismay had no authority aboard Carpathia, Jade said. I think Ismay wanted to get to New York where he had authority to keep the press away, and follow Morgan's orders to quarantine the passengers. The investigation focused the blame on Rostron not picking up bodies, instead of focusing on the reason for the sinking. Shit, that sounds as good as, or better than, any reason I've heard. Bait and switch, agreed Mac. Chapter 42 Atlantic Siren, 1993. Densler held Atlantic Siren steady, as Nemo was put over the side and eased down into the dark water. He'd safely laid Nemo into the blue-green water. There was a dance of sunlight playing its shimmering twinkling rays just under the sea. Jade enjoyed this moment's pleasure. She was noticing little details. She had too. These were drives where death had reared an ugly head. Any mistake could cost the end of the expedition, or lives. Gearheads knew the risks, but they were always suckers for adventure. This was the mother of adventures. Jade was willing to put aside her fear and go. There was such intrigue now, and her mind was working to piece it together. The investigations and the witnesses on the Carpathia and the Mackay Bennett had revealed such different stories. Then there was Master's introverted stance. It all left Jade intrigued and mystified and drew her into the sinking sea. It seemed to mean nothing to Masters. He played his slow jazz during the long drift down, calming his nerves and ignoring her. As Nemo's green eyes pierced the cold water, they came to the sultry vision of Titanic. What Jade had come here for was all changing, as if she was lured in and drunk with it all, but repelled at the same time. "We're coming to the stern profile," said Masters. Flynn brought Nautilus around. Mac, too, wanted answers. He figured it was time to test what Flynn was willing to tell. Surviving a nosedive, as Masters had written as the theory in his books, is still not answered. "Why do you think she went down level?" asked Mac. "Don't know, mate," Flynn answered back. "Ask Masters," said Flynn. "Shit," Mac blocked. "You can ask him anything?" Flynn turned on the radio. "We're almost in position to light you." "We're stern side, focus up," came Masters over the radio. As Nemo moved in toward the starboard stern profile, Jade, Masters and Johns observed even more strange sea life, which had made itself at home in the desolate splendor of Titanic's rusting remains. The strange creatures fled from the unfamiliar light and headed for the safety and security of their home in the interior of the wreck's now dilapidated, yet still majestic, frame. Jade got shots of them. She was fascinated that these creatures were able to survive the inhospitable environment where the inordinate pressures would have crushed the life out of any human venturing there. It took her mind off the agitated Edge Masters carried with him in the small confined craft. "We're at the stern starboard profile," said Masters. "Copy. We'll head in to light it," radioed Flynn. Masters looked in. The stern was a real mess at the point of the tier in the middle. Horribly shredded, jagged, deck planking flopped over the stern where it had torn off. The ship rails had fallen on the deck along with the supports which once held them in place. Some giant torn sheets of iron walls, full of portholes, were lying inward, bent into the deck. The portholes were visible, but the wall they were connected to wasn't in the right place. They were on steel sheets that bent over, twisting outward. The sheets of twisted metal looked like a Picasso interpretation of Titanic. All the parts were in the wrong places. The forward end of the engine room and the first class passenger staircase were fully blown away. A wood ceiling, connected to walls, was lying totally as if it had been blown off and laid sideways. The middle of the stern was twisted like a corkscrew. The rest of stern was scattered across the seabed at distances of 130 to 260 feet from the main body. Masters was eager to get all his shots and build his mosaic so as to really assess Titanic's condition. Jade now understood why the need for the mosaic that Masters was building. Titanic was so huge it would take a mosaic to see all of it. "That's all that's left of the stern. It measures about 350 feet long," said Johns. On the starboard stern bottom run, Masters was hoping to see the boilers, the engine room, or the turbine generators and maybe some of the third-class quarters and the propellers and rudder in this section. "Did you expect it to be like that?" asked Jade.
"No.
I expected the exterior around the midsection to be bad, but the sight is terrible." Masters didn't even look at her. He was focused on the rudder as they headed down to it. The zoom on Jade's camera turned as she carefully held a steady hand and refocused. She caught an exposed bit of the rudder. From the data Masters had compiled and released in his books, he reported that his expedition showed that the stern section rotated like a helicopter blade as it sank. Masters wrote detailed chapters in his book on how it struck, rudder first, burying most of the rudder in the mud up to a depth of 50 feet. It appeared to have swung over at a 30 to 45 degrees angle as the stern went down, causing the section to follow a tight spiral to the bottom. And that's about how it looked. The center propellers buried. Looks like the force of the impact caused the two wing propellers and shafts to bend upwards at a 20 degrees angle, said Johns. They passed by the huge, bronze, starboard side propeller. If you could just salvage that, can you imagine the value? A 38-ton propeller, its scrap value alone would be around $300,000, said Flynn over the radio. But its value as a Titanic artifact would be a ton more, said Johns. The sheer size was so impressive, and indeed, awe-inspiring. As they passed it, Masters did get shots of it with the underwater camera. He was not about to share any of that with Jade unless he determined she would do with it as he wanted. Jade managed to squeeze a shot off the propeller, but she needed a close-up, steady shot of the plate number. Johns passed by too quickly for that. Masters wasn't interested in getting some footage of the huge triple screw, the very thing that defined Titanic, but she wasn't about to ask why. Masters had made it clear she was working for him. Jade would keep her eyes open to get what she could. Her job of filming the crew and the items of interest to Masters came first. They moved to the decks, which were pancaked on top of each other. The hull plating splayed out to the sides of the shattered section. This sounded like a chapter in Masters' book. Whatever Masters wrote made for good reading and had held as the official story, at least in the USA. But there were many other theories. Jade wanted to come in fresh, with her own assessments based upon the many strange facts and questions she began to ask as she angled her camera. With all she had observed documenting Masters and the others, she was beginning to understand what a gearhead was and what drove them to the quest so far below and so far from the safety of distant shores. She was also thinking about the desperate situation the White Star Line was in. Morgan had repairs and insurance to deal with on Olympic. The fear of going bankrupt put Morgan in a delicate position. And now here she was, looking at his ship. The little meter in her camera at the top right in the viewfinder showed the tape was empty. She turned off the camera. Her hand easily reached in her pocket and found the new tape. She slipped it in her mouth while she took out the other tape and then replaced it, putting the used tape in her other pocket. She turned it on and heard the familiar sound of it gearing the tape into place. All within a moment her finger hit the red button. The red record light went on. What she saw was shocking. "Look what happened to the decks," said Johns. What could have caused that? The decks were severely flattened and pancaked. So bad was the damage that they were hardly recognizable in that area. Masters saw it, calculated the measurements and reported. "Atlantic Siren, we are seeing the combined height of the decks packaged, 12 to 15 feet high," said Masters. "Looks like they are piled up on top of the reciprocating engines." Johns hoped the gold was not there. "Looks like the force of the water tore the poop deck up and folded it back on itself," Masters recorded. He noted this so he could recreate Titanic in 3D and in his models could be exact. As Nemo's lights scoped over the stern, Masters could see the damage was severe. Large sections of the hull plating seemed to have fallen off, well before the wreck hit the bottom. Masters was focused on one such section, that he thought to have been from the galleys, which had separated from the stern and landed nearby. "This is one of the weakest parts of the ship as a result of the presence of two large open spaces, the forward end of the engine room and the aft first class passenger staircase. It looks like the rest of this part of the ship is scattered across the seabed 130 to 260 feet from the main part of the stern. They went further. We passed a major chunk of the deckhouse, the base of the third funnel, along with pieces of the third funnel. I'm recording that as large sections of the ship broke off in chunks, and that the ship broke in half between the second and third funnels, not the third and fourth funnels. "Copy that," said Masters. "An explosion hit the hell out of this." "That's part of the boilers on the stern," said Johns. "It looks like the boilers from number one boiler room blew loose and landed in the debris field around the stern,